So thank you so much for coming to our panel today, Building a Jewish Presence Through Social Media. And if you got a chance to review our description, you know that all of us are quite active in social media, though we are parts of various organizations, both religious and private sector. So we're going to go ahead and do some introductions. And Bob, if you want to start us off.
Oh, thanks. I'm Bob Watts. I'm recently retired from a 30-year career as a Foreign Service Officer with the U.S. Department of State in Washington. My last job in the State Department, I ran the division that creates and maintains all the internal social media tools for the State Department. The State Department has an intranet of about 80,000 users, and we created, rather in a bold fashion, a whole suite of open-source software tools on the intranet, including a wiki that now has more than 15,000 articles called the Diplopedia, and other networking and blogging platforms for people to use inside the firewall. We've also been promoting open government initiatives and other activities in linking tech and diplomacy on the outside. Now, I retired and I stayed in the office as a part-time consultant, but I've been using my time to work with a number of Jewish organizations on helping them enhance their presence on the internet, to build their websites, and to build their use of social media to work on their causes. I'm especially active with the International Federation of Jewish Men's Clubs, which is the conservative men's club organization. We have about 20,000 members and 250 clubs worldwide, including one in Chile, one even in Mumbai, India. And so we're working to build up the ability to communicate across that whole network on our initiatives of the club. I'm also working with a local JCC and some other local Jewish organizations on helping build their social media use.
Great.
Thanks.
Right.
Hi, I'm Brian Block, and I have not recently retired from anything. Not for a while. I work at Pierpont Communications in Houston, Texas. It's a full-service PR and marketing firm, and I've been with them for 6 years, managing social media activities, public affairs, and community and civic engagement. I'm also a board member of Jewish Family Service of Houston, and one of the things I was asked to do when they brought me in was to figure out how to get more young people within the Houston Jewish community, a community of which I'm a third-generation Houstonian member, and actually about related to about a quarter of this community. But they asked me to figure out how to get more people, more young people involved in Jewish Family Service, because it's not quite as hip as the JCC, Jewish Federation, Yad, or other young adult events and groups. So that is a little bit of what I'll be talking about today. Thanks for having me, and Chag Sameach.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Joy Bronk, and I'm actually an attorney by trade, but I'm the executive director of the Hebrew Free Loan Association. And the Hebrew Free Loan Association has been in existence since 1932. When I came on board, it was actually pretty much dying. And through social media, I was able to transform that organization into a very active organization, one of now the third largest organizations in Houston, and one that has effectively brought in Jews from not only the traditional Reform, conservative, and Orthodox sects, but unaffiliated Jews as well.
I am William Deroth. I am the Vice President for Public Policy and Director of the Washington Office of the Jewish Federations of North America, which is the umbrella organization of North America's 157 Jewish federations. You should all look down at your iPads and Blackberries and follow me, at Deroth, if you're not already following me. I tweet for myself, for the organization, about Jewish public policy issues, about Jewish issues in general, and about the world in general, and look forward to following you back.
Good afternoon. I'm Lisa Holland Nelson. I'm the president, co-founder, and chief marketing officer of Content Active. Content Active is Houston's leading web and mobile technology company. We do custom web content management systems, mobile websites, SharePoint integrations, and SEO and social media. In my spare time, I also am happy to host Women Mean Business on the Business Makers Show online and on 20 radio stations across the U.S.
Great. So, as you know, this panel is going to take an interesting twist on what it means to be Jewish and how we use social media as Jews and to communicate with Jews. And the first thing that we're going to start off with is a very short snippet of two videos that went viral. And both these videos came from two opposite ends of the spectrum, so to speak. You have one unaffiliated Jew and you have the Chabad. So you have really a dichotomy here of Jewish viral videos in that they are both coming from two different directions but aiming at the same audience.
I am the collective pride and excitement that is felt when we find out that that new actor, that great athlete, his chief of staff, is Jewish. And I am the collective guilt and shame that is felt when we find out that that serial killer, that Ponzi schemer, that wife beater is Jewish. I am the Jewish star tattooed on the chest of the teenager who chooses to rebel against his parents' and grandparents' warnings of a lonely Goyim cemetery by embracing that same Judaism and making permanent his Jewish identity. I am all the words in Yiddish I've been called all my life that I still don't understand. I am going to all three fish shows this weekend.
Are you Jewish? Is your great-great-grandmother Jewish?
Oh, there is no Old Testament.
And I'd come to the meeting at 8 o'clock because you have to walk. It's what?
You don't have to wait 6 hours after milk.
What, BLT? Bagels, lox, and tefillin?
No, Hanukkah is not the most important holiday of the year.
Oh, a cheeseburger is not kosher if you have a rabbi supervision. Do you want to put on tefillin?
Do you know Yiddish?
So as you can see here, we have two very interesting dynamics. And based on these videos, I think the first question that comes up is how do we engage our community? And do we use that engagement to drive change? So I'd like to start with William on this one, because William has, if I say this correctly, over 14,000 Twitter followers. It's pretty impressive. A very large Twitter following, very large Facebook audience. And so I find it, you know, fascinating. I think a lot of us do. How do you use Facebook and Twitter to really drive change within the community and across the United States?
14,000 sounds like a lot until you hang out at South by Southwest and the techie over here has 200,000 followers. So it is, I appreciate all of my tweeps and enjoy Twitter a great deal. I find that the thing I like best about Twitter is the interaction with the Twitter sphere, the interaction with Jews and non-Jews, locally, internationally, about issues that are important. We have used Twitter in order to try to push for petitions to be signed, for folks to call Capitol Hill, things like we just pushed a petition to the Pope while the Pope is going to be in Cuba for him to help free Alan Gross, who's a humanitarian U.S. aid worker, AID worker, who's in prison in Cuba for trying to help the Jewish community, among other things. So it's really a way to engage with the community, and I think more than that, it's a way to have interaction in a way that takes being a Jewish communal leader and making it so we're not up on a big pedestal, but rather having a conversation with people all over the world and trying to really humanize and personalize the work that we do.
So on a different take here, Brian, when you have a large Twitter following and a large Facebook following, or when you're trying to build it, what's the key here to really engaging the audience?
The biggest key in engaging an audience is making sure that you can make a really personal connection. I know that's something that a lot of people have probably heard for years and years, tell a story, make a connection. But it's very true, because if you go to any community's social media presence, you'll see that there is usually a lot more engagement around stories about, let's all congratulate this one particular family on a new birth that they just had, or let's all keep this other family in your thoughts and prayers. That'll do a lot more to drive engagement than promoting something that you already have on your website, such as an upcoming fundraiser or a general program. A lot of people want to see specific names and specific faces within the social media activities.
So this next question, and this is along the same lines, but this is for you, Bob. I know that you also handle the Twitter and guide the Facebook message team for the JCC. And my question for you is, how do you engage these followers and fans so that they feel validated?
Well, I shared a story with the panel that recently the JCC that I'm on the board of and help with their social media activities had a raffle that they were going to raffle off a Mercedes. Well, there was some blowback on the Facebook page about the fact that this Jewish organization got involved with promoting the Mercedes. And the media, the marketing director of the synagogue, who is the main manager of the Facebook page, marketing director of the JCC, deleted the negative comments. There was nothing abusive in the comments. It was just some questioning of doing this, you know. And we had a session where I really tried to train the leadership at the JCC in engaging with their audiences. And that's, you know, as Brian said, that's key to really building the presence and engaging with the community, is to validate everyone's opinion and to try to get the dialogue going across the organization. I think I've also promoted getting as many people out there tweeting or using, providing input for the Facebook or Twitter accounts as possible in an organization where you don't have one stellar person who's willing to do that all the time. By setting a policy, just establishes your message, establishes your goals, and get people together to help build that presence together.
So, Lisa, in the private sector here, now we're dealing with something completely different than your traditional nonprofit, where our tweets and our messages are really geared towards the entire community. So you have a specific client in mind when you're doing these Facebook posts or Twitter feeds, and you have your team managing them. How is that different from the private sector perspective?
I think for me, since I'm the private sector perspective, and I do have a wonderful team managing the social media for my company, when I'm doing it, it's generally about sharing something that's going to make it better for the particular nonprofit, which is what I'm generally promoting. How am I going to raise awareness and start the conversation or enter the conversation or engage people in the conversation? It's not diametrically different than anyone else. It's mm-hmm. For me, almost everything I do is about getting the conversation going, continuing it, managing it, and managing it for the particular nonprofit or whatever I am trying to raise awareness of.
Okay.
I just jump in and say I have a lot of conversations with senior Jewish communal leaders who are scared of Twitter. They're scared of themselves tweeting. Nobody wants to. If I hear one more time, who wants to know when I'm going to the bathroom? I'm going to...
It's not about that.
Make them go to the bathroom. And the other piece, so from a personal level, where people don't think, they don't understand Twitter, and they think it's about the flavor of soft drink we're drinking. And then the second one is a larger issue that I think fits in a little bit to what Bob talked about, which is for most of us to get a press release approved in a large organization takes, if I'm lucky, 6 hours. By the time the PR people and the lawyers and the bosses and their bosses look at something. But for me to tweet right now, 140 characters, a job-ending tweet, I can do it in about 10 seconds. So there's the control issue where the folks who are very old media-oriented don't get the idea of empowering people who are 30 years younger than them with the mission of the organization. And it's a tough issue, but it's one that, you know, if PepsiCo can figure it out, if Microsoft can figure it out, the White House can figure it out, we should be able to figure out.
I found one approach to dealing with that, though, is to try to find with dealing with these senior leaders and who are nervous to use social media is try to find their sweet spot, try to find the tool that they feel most comfortable with using. If they're verbose, get them to use a blog. Get them to, you know, get them to blog. If they like to do presentations, maybe you can set up a YouTube channel to get their some video out. Once they start to feel more comfortable that nothing terrible is going to happen to them once they get out there, then they'll soften up on perhaps using other tools as well.
Well, one approach that I usually take when I'm trying to get, because I'm the youngest person on my board, everybody in the Jewish Family Service Board is about 20, 30, or 40 years older than me plus. And what I do is sometimes I have to actually guilt them into it. I'll say, look, everybody else knows what your grandchildren are doing. Do you really not want to be a part of that? And usually, sometimes that actually really helps them get along. They get interested because they see that there is family life that's happening on there. And that family life is such an important part of Judaism that they want to get more involved. Once they take that little step in there, they start to say, well, what can I do on social media for my organization or the things that I care about? And so you start seeing them become a lot more active step by step, little by little.
I think that you're bringing up an interesting point and one that probably deserves clarification. Social media is many things, as Bob described. What we're talking about mostly here today really is Twitter and Facebook. And what's the difference between Twitter and Facebook, where with Twitter, you're really following a conversation and you can inject some kind of a comment. But if you're on Facebook having a conversation, you're absolutely in it. Everyone is seeing what the group is talking about. So I think that's a very easy way for a senior leader in anything probably to get engaged. The trick, again, is not making it personal, not talking about what you're buying in the grocery store, maintaining the relevance of what the conversation is about.
And I've found it actually to be the exact opposite. So I have actually made it very personal. When in our nonprofit, what we do is we give out interest-free loans to Houstonians, to Jews in Houston. So if you think about it, it's a fairly limited mission that we have. If all I did was tweet about the mission of our organization, it would be a pretty boring Facebook site, pretty boring Twitter feed. But instead, what I do is I partner with different organizations to discuss their missions as well as the more personal aspects. So somebody's grandchild having a bar bat mitzvah will, of course, be celebrated by us, as well as very personal things, such as things that I found at the supermarket, crazy Jewish things that you'll find at the Persian store, all kinds of weird things that bring people into a conversation. Because what I have found is that people will be drawn in if you allow them to be drawn in. But they won't just comment on something that they feel is too out of their genre. So going too religious or not religious enough can both exclude and include people. But when you go on a personal level, it really invites people into the conversation. So maybe not talking about how often we go to the bathroom, but something more interesting, such as, did anyone notice that... I don't know how many of you are Texans, but did anyone notice that HEB put all their Passover stuff outside in a tent as opposed to inside the store? Did anyone find that strange?
Well, it's like with the Christmas trees. That's where it goes.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I maybe I'm a melding of the two here. I think that I try to have personal information as well as businessy communal information to try to personalize who I am, to try to have a relationship with people that people know. I don't tweet my specific information about my kids, for instance, and on Facebook, where I'll only friend people who are my friends, I just refer to them by number, daughter number one and daughter number two, which they love. And but I try to have more, to not just be unidimensional, to not just be, here's a news release we issued, here's an article I thought was interested, but try to make it a little bit brighter and warmer. And I found actually that Foursquare is a way to do that, to really engage with other people who are in Foursquare and other people who are out there to talk about location-based social networking.
I just want to say I think I might have misspoken. I didn't really mean, I'm not, I don't what I meant was I don't tweet that I'm going to the bathroom. I am very engaged with, as everyone knows, I'm very engaged with a lot of organizations. And
this will
I
be
absolutely
the bathroom panel.
Yes. No, I absolutely share interesting and fun and wonderful things about them.
Right.
I really don't get down and dirty about my housekeeper didn't clean the bedroom right or something like that. I mean, I don't do that stuff. And many people do. I mean, I have friends that I stop following who do a lot of that.
Right.
Hashtag bathroom.
Yes, hashtag bathroom.
Down and dirty, did you say that?
Mm-hmm. What may I say?
So that brings an interesting context into this. So as Jews, we have a sense of social responsibility. And Facebook allows a little more room than Twitter. So Twitter allows about 140 characters. Facebook allows you a little more room than that. And then, of course, there's always Google+ or whatever platform you may be using. In what sense does social responsibility come into play into the messages that you post and the things that you write? William, you want to start us off?
Sure. Did Google+, what's that? Don't tell the Google people I said that.
They're at the next panel.
Right, exactly. I think social. We as Jews have an obligation to kun olam, to repair the world, to care for our neighbors as we care for ourselves, to try to make the world a better place. And one of the really cool things about Twitter, about Facebook, and about social media in general is that it does make the world a much smaller place and does allow for us to try to move the world in a better direction, to try to communicate about what's going on in the world. Clearly, we saw this with. For better or for worse now, but clearly at the time for better with the Arab Spring, with the way that social media helped to propel Mubarak out of power, to try to propel the Arab street into seeing democracy and freedom. And as we saw with the Iran election protests in 2009 as well, I think it's an amazing way to connect with people, to connect people together, to cut through so you don't have to have the New York Times or the Houston Chronicle cover your event, but rather you can just through word of mouth, literally, or word of tweet, get the word out to try to activate and to bring about positive social action.
Great. Brian, do you want to bring up the Barron story here?
Sure. For those who aren't familiar, the Barron story?
Barron.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So for those who aren't familiar, because it seems like Houston, you know, for one reason or another, seems to supply a lot of national news, but one of our local Jewish day schools, Barron Academy.
A very small Orthodox day school.
Right. They had signed up with the Texas Association of Parochial and Private Schools basketball regional tournament. And they knew going into it that if they ever made it to the semifinals, that it would be played most likely during Shabbat. A time when Jewish people, many Jewish people, won't do anything. And maybe, I don't know if somebody thought, can we even play basketball? Are we good at that? But lo and behold, they made it to the semifinals. They kept going and going, and they did a great job. So it was time to start playing. TAPPS, the governing organization, wouldn't change the schedules, even though many of the schools participating in the semifinals would change the schedules.
And it was forbidden in the regulations to play on the Christian Shabbat, which is Sunday.
Mm-hmm. So what happened was, is originally the Barron Academy was just going to bow out and say, you know what, we just don't play on Shabbat, and that was going to be the end of it. But what happened was, is the story, the personal connection of the story of the faith and dedication of these students touched a lot of people. But specifically, it touched a lot of the media. So local media started to catch on to the story and started reporting it, and it got bigger and bigger, spread throughout the region, and then eventually made it to the New York Times. And of course, that kind of pressure, along with other sports celebrities, the Houston mayor, and other people calling into the organization, and then eventually actually a lawsuit as well, you know, all of that pressure and support for Barron Academy eventually made the Texas organization say, all right, we'll reschedule it. You guys can play. And we didn't win.
Well, that's okay. That wasn't the point, though. I mean, right. What was really interesting here was that it started off in a tiny little newspaper, the Jewish Herald Voice. So this is one tiny little newspaper in a tiny little community in Houston. And I don't know what the subscriber rate for the Jewish Herald Voice is. It probably hits about 10,000 homes. Mm-hmm. So now it started the Jewish Herald Voice online. From the Jewish Herald Voice, it went straight to the New York Times within 3 hours. From the New York Times, it then went to CNN.com. After it went to CNN, it went to El Paso. After it went to El Paso, it finally hit the Houston Chron by midnight.
Right,
and
yeah,
then
it did a full circle.
Right, it did a full circle to actually come back to Houston. And then, like a whole day later, it went to ESPN.
Yeah, and so, well, there's a few interesting points about that is, one, you never know who's paying attention to what. The national and global press could be paying attention to local stories every chance they get. So you never know. You know, depending on what one person says, exactly how viral it can go and where it can spread. Now, the other thing to think about is if you are an older community leader and you typically have, over the years, you know, known the benefits of having a voice of leadership, and if you're afraid to get on social media and start talking about the community, then you leave it up to other people who might be less educated about community's goals and objectives to be the voice. So you just always have to pay attention to who's talking and exactly what they're saying and who's listening.
All right. And so, Bob, I guess the question that I have for you then is, since we're talking about this sense of social responsibility and how these different stories end up going viral, when you're managing your team of social media experts, how do you communicate that sense of responsibility? Or do you feel it's something that it's innate within them as being Jewish and that it's not really so much of a concern?
The sense of responsibility about the stories that
get out? The sense of responsibility that we have as Jews.
Oh, well, I mean, I think that, you know, I phrased this a different way, or I thought about this a different way given your earlier question, that, you know, I've built up the capacity of in the Federation Jewish Men's Clubs of a lot of guys to understand social media and to use it just in a relatively short amount of time over the last year. So we've actually started to work with other Jewish organizations to help them deliver their message as well. We've been working on a Holocaust remembrance a campaign with another organization. We've also been working with an Israeli advocacy organization to help develop their capacity. And we don't get anything in return for this. This is just our time that we spend with these organizations to try to help them to use social media better and to engage better with their target audiences.
Mm-hmm. So I hate to bring this up because this is something I feel that was manufactured at a very interesting time, but the whole Kony video that's gone viral, right, the day before South by Southwest.
Right.
And so I'm curious if anyone in the audience has opinions about this as well, this idea of Jewish social responsibility in our tweets or in our Facebook posts, and how these kinds of things go viral based on this sense of responsibility that we have. Any comments or questions in regards to that?
While we're waiting for that, there was a funny picture I had seen of a kid holding, you know, his device, and it said above him, like a Facebook status, become a social activist. You know, and clearly you have to do so much more than simply liking something, and, you know, watching a video is good because it's always good to be informed, but...
There's actually a term for it, liketivism.
Liketivism.
Liketivism. Yeah. Interesting.
Activism through the like button. Liketivism. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's interesting, actually, because, and again, bringing up the Kony video. So the Kony video only requested that you share the video. That was their request in the video. And the reason was to make that particular person that they were discussing to become infamous. So by sharing the video, you were doing your part in making this person become infamous. That was the whole point of the video. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether we agree with what they did or any of that is a whole nother matter. But I think it's interesting that, so what you call liketivism is something that's real. Because, in fact, that's what people did. And within 3 days, they had 4 million likes and 4 million views and people sharing it just because they were able to capture that for people who felt they were particularly following and partaking in this sense of social responsibility by liking and sharing the video.
Well, and it's easy to be dismissive of liketivism, but it's better than, notivism? It's better than people not being engaged at all. Clearly we want, you should all run right now for state representative. You should all run for state senate. You should go knock on doors for the candidates of your choice. You should be full-time activists on behalf of the Jewish cause and whatever cause you want. Short of you devoting your entire life to that, there are steps short of that, among them pressing the like button, which is better than nothing. You look at, cause.org, causes.org, which obviously is all about that. It's about people clicking clicking a button to petitions that have had great impact in was in China and Burma, where someone was actually, I think, put in jail because of it. Maybe they got out, but I think it's better than no activism at all.
One of the things, and I guess this is a question for everybody, is how do you turn liketivism into real-world action? Because one of the issues I've seen is that I would like several different items, Facebook status updates, retweet things, but that didn't necessarily mean that I ever donated money to a certain organization, volunteered my time, or took up a leadership role. It wasn't until it was reinforced with somebody in the real world online asking me to join an organization or to volunteer some of my time. So I guess one of the things that I'd be curious to know is how does everybody reinforce that?
I want to answer because I don't think you can ever take the personal touch out of any of this.
Right.
So basically what you're saying, what you started with, is that at least by liking it, you share something that's important to you. Mm-hmm. For some, if it's important enough to like it, you share it without really giving up productive time that you have to do. You have to give to your business or whatever else you have to give it to. In order for you to really engage, somewhere, someone along that food chain has to personally request it, personally touch you, personally create the story that you were talking about in the beginning that compels you to engage. So just liketivism is wonderful, but obviously there has to be much more, and that re-engages the whole integrated everything, because the human is always going to stay in this process no matter how much our heads are down looking at devices. What's going to compel you to do it is that one of your, once somebody you respect tremendously or care a lot about asked you to help, and that's really the be-all end-all.
I've also found that, I'm sorry.
I think it's important, though, to monitor, those responses carefully, too. I mean, as you were getting at, it's kind of a source of mining for
Absolutely.
Information. You see who liked.
Absolutely.
You see who liked it. You see if maybe there's somebody that you could follow up with or
gives you the base,
and engage with the users or the followers. I mean, that's the whole thing that I've been concerned about in seeing the way organizations use use Facebook and such as just as bulletin boards, really, without engaging in this way. I said to somebody at the JCC, okay, are you looking at who's liking the page? No, but we should be, and following up, right?
Well, that's how you source for future leaders. You see, well, who's continuously liking it? We can look at their profile a little more and determine if we should bring them in, ask them if they want to take a more active role.
And I've also found something maybe the opposite to be true, in fact. So, of course, you can determine your base that way, but I often find that the people who are liking certain status updates are the same people over and over again. Facebook and Twitter, for me and our organization, really allows a sense of anonymous comments as well, so they can send messages to you without posting on the board in a way that would be public view. And we've actually started a number of programs based on ideas and feedback that people have been giving through Facebook and Twitter. And I think that the reason is that they feel a personal connection through Facebook and Twitter that they wouldn't necessarily feel if they were doing it through email. Email is a very, it's almost like a blank canvas. So when you're sending an email, it's going out into cyberspace and it's going out to somebody and somebody will answer the email. Whereas when you're sending a Facebook message, it feels much more personal. And they will send you something that will essentially say, you know, I like this, I didn't like that. Can there be a program like this? Can we try to focus the organization to go this way? I mean, they feel a real sense of personal connection to an organization that I think they would not have been able to feel almost in any other format, because certainly people don't walk up to me and ask me to start a loan program that will help people adopt children, but they will have no problem sending me a private Facebook message to request that.
Thoughts on that?
Just for the record, someone tweeted that I coined the term liktivism. I wish I had. Karen tweeted that. Hi, Karen. I did not tweet it. I did not coin it. Actually, this Canadian Israel Jewish advocacy group, CJA, came up with it, as far as I know. But it is a cool term. I'll take credit in the lower 48 states for
How about for spreading it? I think that's really important.
And thank you for tweeting, Karen. Anybody else tweeting here? I'm looking for tweets.
Thank you very much.
Cool.
It's SX Jewish is the hashtag for this. The one that we finally settled on.
Right.
And follow us. There are five of us here to follow.
And
in alphabetical order. Maybe. No, actually, no.
So I guess the next question that comes up, and this is one, when there are cases of need that arise in the community. So, for example, the Berry family. Do you want to discuss what happened with the Berry family?
Sure. So for those who don't recall, or if you hadn't heard in the news, last July, Joshua and Robin Berry were driving back home to Texas from Colorado and ended up in a horrific accident that killed Joshua and Robin, the parents, and left two children paralyzed, all three in the hospital for a time. And what happened was, is first, the way in which the news around it and the community development around it happened was there were just status updates, people saying, did you hear this? What's happening, who has more information. Very quickly, people wanted to know what they could do to help. And so the Joshua and Robin Berry Children's Trust page was created so that people could better organize their fundraisers as well as learn status updates about what's happening. And one of the things that I noticed immediately was that there were a few thousand Jewish Houstonians or Houstonians who had moved away or close friends and family connected to this page. And I thought, a few thousand? That is more than any of the other Facebook communities within Houston had been a part of. Our JFS, JCC, Jewish Federation, all of them only had several hundred people connected to those communities. So it alerted me to the fact that there are certainly more Jewish people in our community online than anyone could believe simply by going to all these other pages. So one of the things that I started wondering about was, sorry, I made some notes, is, you know, why is it that everybody wanted to connect, you know, on these things instead of, why did everybody connect on the Berry Children Trust fan page instead of any of the other places, including Congregation Beth Yeshurun, which is the largest conservative synagogue in the country. And so one of the things that I started to look at was a few reasons as to why people weren't connected to these other local organizations. One was that the organization wasn't doing a good job to manage their community or to promote the fact that they were using social media. Another was that people have a personal bias. They may not like a certain organization, or they may not like a synagogue and just not wish to connect to it. And when they do that, they lose out on any community information being communicated that way. But also, some people just certainly weren't self-motivated to see if the organizations they were a part of in real life were actually online in Facebook. But the Berry tragedy caused a stir in people, an emotional stir that really touched people, and I started to see a lot more interaction. I saw unengaged users, people, especially older people, who had very, very seldomly ever used Facebook to start using it a lot more. They started to realize the benefits of being a part of the Jewish community online, and then eventually started to determine, well, what else can I do? Where else does our Jewish community exist on Facebook? Let me connect with them that way. So definitely, you know, that personal engagement, once again, you know, the life events in our day is what's going to get people moving and really engaged. Simply posting about an event you're having later that evening is not always going to get that same kind of engagement.
Mm-hmm. And the Berry family, and this tragedy, of course, struck very close to home for many of us who know the Berries. This started very much the same way as the Barron Academy, in that it was overnight just a blog. It was an article in the Jewish Herald Voice. I remember when the article was sent to me because I reached out to the people that I knew in the Berry family. I was very upset. And I started calling some of my friends, asking if they had heard what happened to Robin and Josh. The next thing I knew, I was inundated with calls, emails, text messages, Facebook messages, Twitter posts about the Berry family. Justin Bieber was posting about the Berry family. He had created
Kim Kardashian.
They all had posted pictures of themselves with the little heart. And so the heart had become essentially a symbol for the Berry family. And so celebrities were on the red carpet posing with a heart for the Berry family. So it's just fascinating that you have these tragedies that are such horrific things that really, I mean, break the hearts of so many of us and yet bring us all together. And I think Brian raises an interesting point, and I'd like to bring it over to Lisa with this. So we have this tragedy that brings the Jewish community together, and yet they still won't assemble, so to speak, right? They won't get together on one group site. They won't go on one particular page. They still will keep separate. And I want to ask you, in the private sector, when you're dealing with these kinds of things, how do you reach out to, as we showed here on the video, these unassimilated Jews versus Jews that have identified themselves in particular sects?
There has to be some offer that allures them. And I think it depends on the group itself. I honestly don't know what the offer is for the Jewish community. I don't know what would make them stand up and say, I want to belong to the HFLA Facebook page.
Well, I wonder if it maybe is that sense of social responsibility that stems from the Torah. So that sense of injustice that happens, right? So there was a sense of injustice with the Barron Academy. There was a sense of unfairness and injustice with the Berry family. And I do wonder if, when things are fine, that we agree, I mean, this is just a thought, but do we agree to go our own way until the time of need arises when it's time for us to congregate? William, what do you think? Is this crazy? I don't know.
I just am having a thought, and this is a little contrary to the panel itself, but the sense of injustice wasn't a Jewish sense of injustice. It was a national sense of injustice for the Berry family. I mean, it was Justin Bieber. I mean, it was a terrible tragedy that went viral so quickly, and I don't know that religion had anything to do with it. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity within the Jewish community to engage without the lure of religion or guilt. Just engage around the cause of creating the JCC, which is the most wonderful place for your children and family to be. Not just because you're Jewish, but I mean, there's a lot of people that would love to be there anyway. So I'm thinking that, and we've, forgive me everyone, I'm going to share a little bit about the fact that I have introduced myself to each of these people as probably the most assimilated Jewish person they may ever meet. I mean, I grew up in a part of Houston that had no Jews but my family from the time I was 9 years old, went to school with no other Jew but myself, went to church on the weekends and Sunday school at Beth Israel. So I never have felt that I had to be in that community to be Jewish and to bring the crowd of Jews to whatever, you know, I was engaged in. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, I may not be the right person to answer, but I think, again, whatever compels me to stand up and do something is what compels any group.
I'd have 2 points. One is I'm thrilled that Justin Bieber is mentioned. Every time I tweet Justin Bieber's name, I get at least 15 more followers.
Yay.
So thank you for giving me an excuse to do that. And you just retweeted me tweeting about Justin Bieber.
And I never tweet his name, so I need to start.
You'll see that I don't know if they're old enough to legally be on Twitter, but they're out there, and there are many of them. So all hail King Justin, who, by the way, has a Hebrew language tattoo on his neck that he and his father both got together when they were in Israel. You can tweet that, too.
I was going to say, did he think he was supposed to be Chinese for something?
I think he did say that, didn't he?
He just turned 18, also, while we're doing Justin Bieber trivia. The second point is that I see part of our role in the Jewish community is to try to engage people in Jewish life. It is to take someone who grew up as the only Jew in a neighborhood, and that was your Jewish identity. That's mm-hmm. what, and is your Jewish identity.
Yes.
And to awaken that, to have as many on-ramps as we can for Jewish engagement, for Jewish activism, as the Chabadniks would say, to bring forth your neshama, your Jewish spirit and your Jewish soul. And if that means that the way to get folks engaged in Jewish life, to get them engaged in the community that their grandparents and great-great-grandparents all the way back to Sinai were engaged in the Jewish world, is through social media, great. Kol HaKavod. It's fantastic. If it's by helping those who are in need, like this family, I think that's great. If it's picking coffee beans with the American Jewish World Service in Guatemala, if it's knocking on doors, if it's occupying City Hall, I think that's great. If it's pro-Israel activism, if it's Hebrew Free Loan, et cetera, men's club activism. So I see this. I see social media as a real tool to help awaken and to have those on-ramps for Jewish activism, for Jewish engagement out there. And I think it, again, is just an amazing tool to make the Jewish world a smaller place.
Mm-hmm. I think an interesting thing, though, that we've been developing here is really like the power of stories in getting the message out, which are often much more effective than citing statistics or, you know, promoting a single message. But the story part is very important. I mean, and Jews are great storytellers, so we should harness that ability to tell our stories. I have a recent example of in February on Super Bowl Sunday, the Federation does something called the Worldwide Wrap, where on the morning of Super Bowl Sunday, we try to get as many people, not just guys, women too, to come and put on tefillin in the morning service and teach the kids how to do it too. And we sometimes have a program afterwards in the synagogue in Toronto of somebody I'm active with in the Federation. They had some Israeli students in to talk about, you know, Israel advocacy issues also as part of that. And, you know, they were getting some flack about the wall from the people in attendance. And you know, instead of citing statistics about, you know, any threats to Israel or about how Israel is beleaguered, they really told their personal stories of being, feeling threatened in their security and living near where the wall is being put up in Israel. And the fact that they told some very personal stories about this as opposed to just talking theoretically really impacted the crowd, and they had a great audience for this. And you know, I don't think we do that enough in pushing the message out. I think that people here have been talking about the power of the stories that we can tell.
I think that's a really good point. So then my next question would come in this respect. So we all have a different aspect in which we're coming from, the private sector versus government and then to public sector, as well as through nonprofits and NGOs. So when you're trying to convey a message, perhaps to someone who wouldn't fully understand the message, and you need to express it in a condensed and highly specific way, what would be the most specific way that you could really, and most effective way, that you could really reach your audience and convey your message? So, and we're talking in very general terms here, but we have a way to look at the issue, to look at the problem, and to really direct it in a particular manner. Is there some general format for something like this, or is this something that's just on a case-by-case basis?
Well, I don't know that there's a, you know, when you're talking Jewish people, I don't know that you can really condense any message. But I think it just depends on, you have to sort of be a native of any community or to become a native of any community in order to understand what's going to be the most efficient and condensed way of spreading whatever that effective message is going to be. So it may not, I don't think it'll ever be posting one message in one spot. You have to go find out where all of the little individual communities, you know, people who think that their little community is the best community amongst the entire city, state, or country. And you just have to keep pushing something and just be consistent with your message. I mean, that's something we're good at, is consistently repeating our message again and again and again. So.
I mean, I don't know that we have a problem condensing. I mean, I think that the Ten Commandments, you talk about just an amazingly brief and succinct and timely.
But then followed by 613 laws.
Sure. Okay, so there's 603 others. But the Big Ten are out there. I think that they're... I find that putting stuff in 140 characters is difficult. It's a hassle. I find, though, that it actually makes the rest of my communication better. I tend to get rid of words that are unnecessary. See if I can do that while I'm speaking. And it's sometimes we get in trouble for it, too. You can Google. The head of new media for a major world leader said that when the world leader was started, he told his boss that he would want to be very engaged in new media and that he was going to make three mistakes and that he should just recognize that from the beginning he was going to make three mistakes and let him have those three mistakes. I saw him, you can figure out who this was, I saw him earlier this week in Washington, and he told me that he's made two now and he has one to go, and he handed me his resume. No, he didn't hand me his resume. But this is, I think all of us, when we're talking about 140 characters, it's very difficult to get the nuance in. It's very difficult to be precise. And it's very easy to offend or to be misinterpreted. And it's something that hopefully the Twitter world gets. The new bureau chief for the New York Times, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times, if you do some Googling, has had some issues with her tweeting, where some folks on the right think that she's being problematic. It's something that I think we have to recognize, that it is a new world order. It's a new mechanism to get out there and give some slack.
I don't disagree. I agree with you totally. Nothing else to join in.
No, I think that part of it is getting just getting the conversations going, I think, is very important. You know, who's better at having multiple conversations at the same time than Jews, right? And getting conversations going around a subject where people are engaging actively back and forth, doing in terms of Twitter or Facebook, doing live sessions even is one thing you can do, just from a practical point of view. So you have some real-time engagement over the social media. I mean, William is the most active there, so he really gets things out. But it's keeping the stream going, too, I think, practically helps build the following, helps keep your audience engaged. And I think, as other people have said, when you have, even if you need to reach out to find some information to put in there when you don't really have something substantive to say about what's happening with you exactly, to keep people interested, so that when you do have something important to say, they're still following you.
So back to liketivism then.
Well, and it's in the small world department, I tweeted, it was Dan Haddad with the Canadians who came up with the idea of liketivism, and I tweeted that it was him, and Dan has responded on Twitter. Is there a better example for liketivism than what we've seen with Coney, which is how we got to this whole discussion in the small world department?
So I know there were a couple comments on Twitter, and I'm just curious if there's anyone that wants to add anything to this conversation, because certainly, I mean, we're taking it from just a couple of perspectives, but there are certainly people out in the audience who are just as well-versed, if not more, on Twitter and Facebook and addressing the community. And if there are any comments, questions, thoughts.
I probably don't need the microphone. I'm pretty noisy. Where do you find Jewish communities out there online? That's one of the most difficult parts for us. Is there's a lot of very, very intensely small communities. How do you network those communities? Or when you're kind of building that, where do you find those communities at?
I've had to do that for projects within, you know, other, well, within our community, but also for clients at work, where you have to go, and it's not always easily accessible to find a nice list online that says, oh, well, here's all the Facebook pages, Twitter pages, and groups and Hangouts and everything. And the best thing to do is actually pick up the phone and start calling certain people who you think would be like a leader within a certain community who's going to have more information. And they'll start giving you names of organizations or people who can help you out, and then you can start researching that online. Because sometimes you're looking for an organization that may have a large number of people, but they don't know a very good way to make sure that their presence is widely known or easily found. So usually just calling people and is one of the fastest ways I've been able to make it happen.
I've started a delicious page just with links to all the different organizations. So, you know, I can tweet that out. I'm at DigiMaven. And then I also, on the fjmc.org website, we have a whole page of links to a wide range of Jewish organizations.
So I think your comment of taking old school tools to use new school tools is very interesting.
They involve old school people.
They do, but I've also found that there are two different ways that I'll go about finding people on Facebook. One is, whenever I meet someone, rather than exchanging business cards, I'll friend them on Facebook. And that makes things a lot easier for me as an executive director of a nonprofit, but also helps build the fan base, because, of course, on Facebook now, they have a wonderful new feature for us where so-and-so likes your posts and so-and-so is friends with so-and-so. And the next thing you know, you're friending people or finding people that are in the Jewish community that would have necessarily have been part of it. And then the other thing is, when you're posting content that's relative to the community, I think when you're posting things that people want to repost, that people want to retweet, that's another way to really build the Jewish community, because people are interested in these kinds of things. Karen?
I'm pretty loud too. I find that Twitter is fascinating because there's such a diverse Jewish community globally, and I just keep a list. And there's also this kind of very very interesting urban kind of media and all kinds of cool things going on. If you're looking for people at the holidays, you hashtag the holiday, and you will find a global response that is just from right to left to everywhere from around the world, and it's fascinating. And then from there, I would go on to find their Facebook, and I've met some very amazing people. And it's nice to meet Mr. Daroff here in real life for the first time, because I saw you on Twitter, probably the same way.
Just call me at Daroff. I'd add to that. There are some lists out there. My colleagues at the Jewish Federations, at J Federations, have some lists, if you are on Twitter.com, of all the Jewish Federations, for instance, the ones that are engaged, and there are over 100 that are engaged. JTA has done lists of top 100 Twitterers. They've done that 2 years in a row, where you can go through. The Forward has a list that they put up. So there are, but I agree, going on the hashtag, seeing who is tweeting about Purim during the last week, you'll get a good sense for who's out there and who's active. And there's one last point I'll make as we end in time. I don't think it's necessary for all of us to be as totally engaged in Twitter as Justin Bieber is. Third reference. The having your toe in the water with social media is better than, in my view, is better than not being engaged at all. It's totally acceptable. It's fine to be a voyeur on social media, to just look, to learn. If there are people out there who, and I know someone didn't want us to make more potty references on Twitter. If
they demanded it, didn't they?
if the guy from the JCC, where's he? The theater maven or something?
See, Leo,
there we go.
There he is.
Sorry about that. And one more bathroom. It doesn't have to be if people who are hesitant about being engaged. I tell them just follow people you're interested in. Follow Anderson Cooper. Follow Oprah. Follow Justin Bieber. Follow the 5 or 6 people you're interested in. Follow me, of course, and see what's going on in the world. Follow the New York Times and use that as an inroad to see if this is something that interests you. And I don't see how it could not interest you if you're really just following the people that really interest you in the world. Follow your kids, follow your grandchildren.
Can I just add one thing? Mm-hmm. Because you said to look and learn, and I also want to reiterate to run interference. If you're out there with your Jewish community, your Jewish nonprofit, your whatever, you need to know what people are saying. And honestly, in many cases, you need to be the person to divert attention, to respond to attention, to know it at all times. I think that's very important.
And to act proportionally. There are people out there who give me a hard, hard time, and they have 12 followers. I act differently than when someone gives me a hard, hard time who has 20,000 followers. So it's important to everybody should have their day. Everybody, I interact with everybody, but the people who are out there, what is it they call it? Trolling. Thank you. People who I tried to eliminate all trolling. People who are out there trolling who have no following. I give them the amount of time that is due to them.
So I'd like to thank everyone for coming, and of course, I'd like to thank Three Brothers for donating all that delicious hamantaschen. If you liked it, go ahead and Facebook them, Twitter them, let them know how much you appreciated their hamantaschen. And it was great meeting you all, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you.
Thank you.